Many don't believe that either the trumpets with melodious noise or the infernal din await us where the road ends. But most, I fancy, have discovered that to be born is to be exposed to delights and miseries greater than imagination could have anticipated. That the choice of ways at any crossroads may be more important than we think, and that shortcuts may lead to very nasty places.
Hello, and welcome back to the Pilgrims Podcast. This is the Progeny speaking. I'm also joined by the professor out of Oxfordshire, and
the Patriarch
over here. Yep. And this week we're going to be talking about Possession from 2002, which was a recommendation from one of our listeners, Daryl Sala. Thank you. And which I enjoyed.
Possession is 9/10 of the law. Did you know that?
Is it?
Yes.
Hmm.
But I don't understand why they call it Possession, the movie.
Well, that's what we're going to talk about a little bit. Well, I have a few other things we might talk about first. Just to, since we're hanging out.
Break the ice.
Yeah, break the ice. So, they've announced the cast for the new Star Wars movie, which is called Rogue One. Which, you know, because this one was called Rogue One, and because the new Mission Impossible was called Rogue Nation, there was a little bit of a legal tussle over all that. But I think they sorted it out. Anyway.
I'm sure they did. The lawyers were poised.
Hmm. Yep. Well,
engaged.
I don't know whether I'm optimistic about this film or not. It looks kind of cool to me. I like Felicity Jones and what I've seen her in. I saw her in Northanger Abbey. Is that how that's pronounced? I don't know. That's one of the Jane Austens I'm not terribly familiar with. As you might recall, she was our pick for Lucy Manette in our Dreamcast for Tale of Two Cities. But she's playing the main character. She's joined by...
I'm sure they recall that. I'm sure they've taken notes.
I'm sure they do, yeah.
And they oh yeah,
I was
know.
Talking to you.
No.
Anyway.
I thought you were talking to our public.
Well, I could be doing that too, but... So.
She's eating an ice cream cone. Mm-hmm. That's the reason that you do this.
Normally, it's you over there crunching on the milk duds, so...
No milk duds. I'm milk dudless.
Well, we've got... So, Felicity Jones is the main character, and she's also joined by Diego Luna, Ben Mendelsohn, Donnie Yen...
These are people nobody knows.
Jiang Wen...
Why are you doing this?
I don't know them, but now a few people that you might know, like Forrest Whitaker, he's been in some major things, and Mads Mikkelsen, we're... a pretty big fan of him in a movie called Adam's Apples.
Yeah.
Though he's best known these days for playing Hannibal on TV. He's good.
Yeah, he's cool.
When you saw that he was going to be in this movie, though, it was automatic. You were like, yeah, I bet he's going to play a good guy. No. About the most relevant one to me, though, is that Alan Tudyk is going to be in this, which I think is kind of... karma for Firefly being canceled back in the day. Maybe he'll get to be a pilot. That would be great. And it looks like that might be what the plot is, because the idea is that they're kind of this team of kind of gangster types, I think, sort of Han Solo-ish, who steal the plans to the Death Star.
It's probably a ripoff of your Firefly stuff.
I mean, possibly, yeah.
They can't come up with any original ideas in Hollywood anymore.
That would be true.
They should hire us to play that kind of stuff. By golly, we'd give them something for that.
Yeah, what would be your ideal science fiction plot? Because I know you...
Amazon women, for starters. A whole planet.
A whole planet. Meanwhile, this kind of...
I mean, if you're going to go for the 18 to 30 men demographic, just go for it. You know, if you're going to go for it, just do it. You know?
Yeah. Well, you're off to a good start.
I don't know. I'll think about that. The ultimate
completely populated, completely populated by Rebecca Ferguson from Mission Impossible.
You know that? Yeah. Clones, like a million clones. I don't know. I'll think about that.
I know you've dabbled in science fiction occasionally. Back in the day, there was that story about the guy that was traveling at light speed and talking to his computer, I think.
Back in the day, when I was a wee lad.
Yeah.
He would involve trees. Hmm. He would involve trees.
What?
Because nothing says science fiction like trees. Right? I mean, trees are the ultimate, there's lots of trees.
Well, when I hear of trees, I think of fantasy, like Ents and stuff, because trees are such an earth thing.
I know, that's what I say. They've made movies about scary birds and scary sharks and scary people and scary zombies, but never anyone on scary trees. So that's a horror movie though. Science fiction, I'll have to think about that. I'll think about it.
Pan's Labyrinth had some pretty scary trees.
Well,
I am Groot.
Yeah, that's not scary at all.
But yeah, that's true. So, in this world of scary trees and Amazon women, in comes this sort of middle-aged Earthling dude who's just kind of bumbling along in his spacecraft and lands on the Amazon.
No trees. Although I think it'd be cool to have live trees. But
I think that's a cool idea. Except there would be something otherworldly about the trees.
It'd be like, 900 feet tall or something.
Yeah, that would be cool. And there would be cities in the trees. Like Lothlorien, but with guns and sword fights in the trees. You know, I wrote a book once when I was a kid. Actually, I wrote many books when I was a kid, but one of them I remember was about like this entire colony of robbers that lived in the treetops in this creepy forest, and there were snakes, giant snakes up, down on the ground, so you couldn't walk on the ground, and there were all sorts of pitfalls and everything, so you had to jump from tree to tree, and they had like this, they would train the prospective rebel outlaw type things, and they would jump from tree to tree and shoot at people with their arrows. It was pretty cool.
You make it like the whole planet is one big tree or something like that,
That's cool.
And that, I think about that.
One of the neater alternate reality worlds that I remember reading about as a kid was one called the Edge Chronicles. And that was really neat because it created just this entire really unique creation, and it was complemented by an illustrator who really knew what he was doing, so he could visualize that really well. And I read all those to my brother, but they were really neat. So anyway,
I can tell you what I wouldn't do. Anyway, we won't go down that rabbit trail.
What wouldn't you do?
Ewoks and Jar Jar Binks.
Well, that's true.
What else? Like I said, no need to go down that rabbit trail.
Well, that's pretty much all we know about Rogue One.
Other than the original ending of Star Wars, would have been a lot cooler than what it really was.
Yeah, we were talking about that. Well, I don't think we've mentioned it on the podcast, but somebody the other day was saying that Lawrence Kasdan's original ending to Return of the Jedi was super grim and dark and Shakespearean. It's like Macbeth or something.
It would have been so awesome.
Because in it, are we going to do Return of the Jedi sometime?
No.
Oh, okay. I think we need to before the new movie comes out.
I'm not interested in Star Wars.
Well, we'll see if I can talk you into it before then. Anyway, the original ending was that Han Solo died and Princess Leia became the lonely ruler to the kingdom, I guess. And
she married Donald Trump.
That is grim. Now, that would break hearts. Whose hair, as it turns out, was shorn from an Ewok. Or maybe it was one of those little things from Star Trek, the little fluffy things. What do they call them?
Tribbles.
Tribbles. Yeah, maybe Donald Trump. Donald Tribble. Trump.
T-Rump.
I killed myself.
Donald T-Rump.
Anyway, and then Luke, at the end of the original ending, basically becomes Darth Vader. I think he becomes the bad guy.
So somewhere along they would have had to change the name. Return of the Jedi would have been like something else.
Yeah.
Return of the Sith. Or
I think Revenge of the Sith was actually the original title to Return of the Jedi.
Well, there you have it.
Hmm. So, alternate endings.
I mean, people like happy endings, but people don't forget bad endings.
The Godfather was epic because it wasn't afraid to end on a note of complete, utter ruin.
Hamlet, as I recall, doesn't have a really cheery ending. Right?
Depends on who you are, I guess. If you're Fortinbras,
like
then you
anybody
come in.
That's you know, yeah, anybody that's still standing.
Yeah.
But
poor Horatio.
But you know, people remember that stuff. They remember. You should have a podcast sometimes on best endings of movies.
Yeah, that would be interesting because I think somebody was talking about that on Twitter the other day. Just what it takes to wrap up a story and give you a sense of closure, while you know not just completely checking off all the boxes and leaving a little bit open ended, doing different things. I think Lord of the Rings did that really well, even though Peter Jackson can be accused of having too many endings. Harry Potter, I was not a huge fan of the way they ended that, they split it into two parts, and the first part I really hated because it was just ridiculous, and they betrayed the book in just really unconscionable ways. But the second half I don't remember as much about. Maybe it was just kind of paint by the numbers, I think. Anyway, so it is Robert De Niro's birthday today.
So wonderful for him.
What's your favorite De Niro movie?
I should have
told you about that this question before we started recording, but
well,
I can say.
Why are you so unpopular with the Chicago police?
I like Midnight Run very much, but I also like him in other movies. I haven't seen him in too many movies. I've seen him in like four. I haven't seen any of his major work.
We won't let you watch movies with that much language.
That's true, you know, because I just don't hear that much.
Robert De Niro, his middle name has got to have four letters in it.
Yep.
With probably ING on the end of it or something like that, but yeah.
Well,
I just, you know,
he was good in Midnight not Midnight Run.
He was in The Untouchables. He played Al Capone in The Untouchables.
He was good in The Mission. That was a good movie.
He was good in The Mission.
The first third of that movie is just about perfect.
But we've never seen Taxi. Taxi Driver?
Yeah, I haven't seen Taxi Driver or Raging Bull, which are kind of his major movies. I kind of want to see Taxi Driver, but even though I know how it ends. But I'm not going to spoil that for our listeners, because we're the home of the almost permanent spoiler.
Home of the permanent spoiler.
So, yeah, he was good in that. He was good in The Godfather Part II, you know, though he had a supporting role there. That was still Al Pacino's movie. He wasn't bad in Stardust, though they overused him. So, anyway, we need to get to our movie. I'll kind of summarize what the movie is about, and then we can go on to talking about it. It was made in 2002, and it stars Aaron Eckhart and Gwyneth Paltrow and Jeremy Northam and Jennifer Ely and just about every period drama actor that we have seen in anything. Which I enjoyed seeing all of them put together in a film. And it's a historical mystery, kind of in the vein of National Treasure or The Daughter of Time or even the Da Vinci Code. It's about this pair of literary historians, one of whom is played by Eckhart and the other whom is played by Gwyneth Paltrow. They're named Roland and Maud, respectively. And Roland one day discovers some letters which are secreted away in one of the personal books of the guy he's researching, who was a poet named Randolph Henry Ashe. And Roland reads these letters and is very surprised, and he realizes that nobody's found them before and that this could be a lot of money, but he also discovers that these are letters to some other woman other than the man's wife. And the man was famous for being really faithful to his wife. Now, this could be a huge literary discovery. It would light up the whole literary establishment. So he he steals the letters and goes off to investigate. He ends up meeting Gwyneth Paltrow along the way, and it turns out that she's investigating the woman who he thinks Ash was involved with, and as it turns out, there was an affair, and the two of them investigate it, and the movie cuts between the perspectives of the investigators in the present day and Randolph Henry Ash and Christabel Lamotte, who was the other poet, and their romance. And so it's kind of it's a mystery and it's a romance at the same time, because inevitably, of course, Paltrow and Eckhart end up becoming a couple fairly quickly. So it kind of throws all of those things together, and it's based on a book from 1990 by A.S. Byatt. And it was very well received, the book was, and it sounds, if there's anything I can say about the movie, it was that it really intrigued me about the book, because I think the movie really just kind of is the tip of the iceberg. It felt like it a sort of an underbaked version of something that was much larger. For instance, the movie frequently quotes the words of the poets, and I thought, that's really interesting poetry. That's really compelling. That sounds very authentic. That doesn't sound like something the guy who wrote the rest of this movie would write. Because the jumping between the two stories can feel a little jarring sometimes. Though the direction's sort of interesting. I understand that this is a very unusual movie for him to choose to direct. Normally he directs totally different, very modern, very American movies, and this is him kind of delving into a British literary history movie, which was just not at all his style, and you can kind of tell. So I guess we'll start out by talking about just the romance. You've got two romances going parallel. You know, did you find either of them convincing or immersive in a way that made you care about the characters?
No. No,
and if not, why not?
I just don't think the chemistry was there. The chemistry. I wondered last night if it would have worked if they'd switched Paltrow and Ely's characters. I almost think that would have worked better.
Possibly, yeah.
Because I'll say this, whilst I think she's kind of a loathsome person, and someone with whom I have very little, from what I've read, who knows what kind of woman she is, but if you believe what you're reading on the internets, on the interweb, you know, then Gwyneth Paltrow sounds like a pretty horrible person. But she, in my opinion, she acted circles around everybody else in that movie. You know, I like her a lot. You know, she's just somebody that you just want to like a lot. And it's like in Emma, you know, she's just like the sweetest, kindest. I'd call her whatever, but I really buy into her acting. And I felt like Jennifer Ely, she was trying to do this, kind of this aloof, literary, highbrow person, and I guess it just didn't have enough background to develop her character. You know, they just dropped her into the middle of this, and you know, like one of the first scenes, you're supposed to believe that she's just falling for this guy or something.
Well, my problem with all of the characters, all four of the main characters, is that you don't get any background information on any of them.
Right,
which is something I suspect does happen in the novel.
And it's hard to do, right?
Oh, yeah, you know, but yeah. It starts out, and there is Aaron Eckhart being this kind of hunky guy that just looks at books all day, and he just wants an adventure, and he's the brash American guy, and he sweeps in to enliven the lives of women. And that seems to be his purpose in life.
And, a lot like mine.
Well, there you go, yeah. And, yeah.
And no doubt Daryl's. us engineers, we just got charisma. We just oozing charisma.
It's true.
Yeah.
I
can take my Sharpie and draw a little chin on my chin here, a little
I'm thinking of one particular engineer. Anyway, yeah, so the two poets, on the other hand, the movie kind of feels as if you're supposed to know who they are already, but of course they never existed. And I've read a little bit of kind of 19th century poets. I've taken a course in American literature and early that period I'm fairly familiar with. So they felt very authentic as people of their period. But because we don't know anything of what they were like, except a few throwaway lines that, you know, at the beginning, Eckhart, he says, well, Ashe was famously faithful to his wife. And that's pretty much the only thing we know about him.
Right. And it might have helped a little bit had I known that we were talking about major fictional literary figures.
Yeah.
You know? I mean, that might have helped lay the groundwork a little bit, because it took me a few minutes at least to figure out, oh, this Ashe is fictional, number one, but number two, he's really, really famous fictionally.
Yeah.
Right? And so that might have helped a little bit.
It's not just like some family history that somebody's doing. Yeah.
Right.
This is actually a big discovery.
And part of the way they did that is they had those big banners out in front of the library or whatever with his face on it, like, ah, well, this is supposed to be a famous guy then. They wouldn't put his face in 14-foot banners.
Yeah, and I really felt bad for Jennifer Ely and Jeremy Norson because I felt like their whole romance was kind of shortchanged by the cutting.
Yes.
Because it started so quickly and they were so immediately in love. It says, okay, they wrote back and forth and were entranced by each other's wit. And I'm like, what wit? Where? Where?
Yeah.
Please. I want to know. You know,
yeah,
and
she... Go ahead.
And this is a movie which... and I did enjoy it, for what it's worth. But I really wish that they could have spent some time for that to flower, because I love Jeremy Norsom, and I love Jennifer Ely, and I like Mr. Knightley better than I like Mr. Darcy, and I like Lizzie better than Emma. So this is like a dream pairing for me. Because, of course, Northam's famous for playing Knightley and Ely for playing Elizabeth Bennet. So I was just kind of geeking out about that. But they just didn't... Maybe it's just that they don't have chemistry together.
Well,
but
part of it, again, I think, was their character development. It didn't really get very deep. And then poor Jennifer, I don't think she got to smile once in the whole movie.
That's true. She just kind of floated through the movie.
Yes, and she just kind of... try to do the smoldering thing, and it just didn't work too well. But there are moments in Pride and Prejudice where she breaks into the smile, and you got that little gap in between her front teeth, and that's all cute. And after you see it about 50 times, which I've at least seen 50 times, it's like, oh, she doesn't even have a gap between her front teeth.
I've seen it at least 50 times and never noticed that. So.
Yeah,
well. There you go. You learn something new every day.
It's not a Lauren... Lauren, what's her name's gap between her front teeth? I forget her name. She's this famous model. She had a gap between her front teeth that you could put, you know, a stack of index cards in. No, it was Lauren Hutton. I think that's her name.
Yeah. I thought that... I watched... And it was interesting because I was... We returned the movie to the library, and... Earlier today I was writing a question, so I was watching clips on YouTube, and I watched a compilation of all of the Jennifer Ely, Jeremy Norsom clips, or it wasn't all of them, but it was most of them, and I watched that, and it just seemed to work so much better when it was just, there was a long enough period for them to focus.
Yeah, I could see that.
And I started to pay attention to Ely doing her thing,
yeah.
And she was being really good. In a movie that didn't seem to understand what she was, that was on a different frequency.
You know, I could see that, because you were switching back and forth, and so you were kind of trying to figure out what was going on in Gwyneth Paltrow's head, and then all of a sudden you were into this other story and I also thought maybe they're trying to make this tie between this modern couple and that. The old couple, the historic couple. I thought, well, maybe they're trying to tie these two together. There's a movie out there called Dead Again.
Yeah, yeah, I remember you talking
Kenneth
about
Kenneth Branagh and then his
Derek
wife.
Derek Jacobi.
Yeah, and
Emma Thompson.
Emma Thompson, yeah. But the neat thing about that, and I watched it again, I don't know, a few years ago, and it's like, yeah, this is pretty cheesy. But it was pretty neat that they had a modern couple, and they were played by the same couple, right? And this historic couple. But it was little things that they would do that would, like, parallel.
Mm-hmm.
And one of the neat things, like, was the historic couple was, you know, he was reading her palm or something. And in the modern couple, he was reading the tea leaves in the bottom of the coffee cup or the tea cup. Little things like that that were pretty cool. But I didn't know. Anyway, long story way to go around the barn there, but I was wondering if they were trying to pull off something similar to that. But,
well, I understand that in the novel that was a theme that was more focused on, but I think that does happen here. There are definitely parallels. On the one hand, and here's one thing that I noted, it social mores confine the two historical romantic couples. Ash is dissatisfied with his wife and cannot leave her to be with Christabel, who was living in a lesbian relationship, not so much accepted as tolerated by society. So they're both in vaguely respectable situations. And while the film never really addresses the issue, there's a general sense that they cannot be together because society forces them apart. And they don't go too deep on that. But on the other hand, our modern heroes are constrained by a completely different set of inhibitions, self-imposed. They have a conversation at one point just before they decide to become a couple or about to become a couple, and they say, I've got the transcript here somewhere. Let's see.
Do I get to read his part?
Oh, well, it doesn't say which is his part or hers, though, so we'll just have to, maybe we'll just get lucky. Oh, let's see. Here we go.
It's Freud. On the other side of attraction lies repulsion. Or was that Calvin Klein?
Do you believe that?
I wouldn't know.
I don't allow myself to do that Ash Christabel grand passion thing.
Allow? No.
I don't know who's speaking now.
I don't know what's going on here.
Jealousy, obsession, all that. Not anymore.
You're lucky, then.
It all gets so, just such a tangle.
It's a tangle most people want.
Not me, though.
My annex made a lot of people unhappy.
One horribly so.
For me.
Oh, wait a minute, that's me.
See, I don't know what I'm doing here.
For me, whenever I feel anything for anyone, I go cold all over.
What makes you do that?
Fear, I suppose. Fear of being burned up by love.
Listen to us. Yes.
Aren't we just modern?
Mod.
You should
let your hair out. You should let it breathe.
Okay, well, I guess we should do the next two lines because they're relevant.
I am ready to move to Hollywood.
You have got it. You just got that. You've got that theatrical...
natural sex appeal.
Oh, yeah. You were just smoldering through those last few lines. Anyway, then you say...
Don't do the icy thing. You have nothing to worry about for me.
Christabel said, fear all men.
Yeah, well, Christabel didn't know me. I don't want to take anything from you.
So then we're both perfectly
safe. Right?
So...
I don't know what we're talking about. Where was this going?
Anyway, that's basically the scene. She talks about how she's worried about committing. She says she doesn't want to do the whole grand passion thing, and how she was so afraid of seeming needy that she had even shaved all of her hair off at one point to. She's just really not happy committing because she's afraid of that, afraid of danger, I guess. And he, of course, takes that opportunity to quote Freud or Calvin Klein, whichever it is, and try and convince her that she can commit safely with him because he doesn't want to take anything from her. He doesn't want to possess her. It's not a matter of possession. He wants to...
She's not being two-faced about it.
Yes, as it were. And by the way, Iron Man is probably going to be a little bit mad that his girlfriend has run off with Two-Face Harvey Dent. Yeah. And that was another thing about this movie. It was so weird because it was like, Lizzie Bennet and Mr. Knightley were hanging out over there, and then Emma and Two-Faced Harvey Dent, and then over there there's Miss Prism from Importance of Being Earnest, and that guy from Inspector Allen, and then Mr. Rochester and that guy from Waking the Dead were the bad guys. So it was kind of fun playing spot the actor.
You're right.
And I must say, Daryl, it was a great choice because that is just in our niche of interest. We love playing spot the actor. I'm probably gonna watch Gosford Park with the Patriarch and the Matriarch sometime, and that's another one which has so many actors I know. It's just
yeah,
insane.
Even the dude with it was behind the counter at one of those. I just knew I'd seen him.
Yeah, the guy with the Yorkshire accent.
At the jewelry store.
Yeah, I don't think I looked up who he was.
Anyway.
Yeah, and Ash's wife was in Waking the Dead too, so that was two of them. Anyway.
Which was another problem, right?
Yeah, and it didn't. I don't think that I the way I was approaching the movie was I was saying, okay, this movie isn't making a moral judgment on that. Mm-hmm. Somewhat. I mean, because at some point you're thinking, okay, they're looking at it as this is a historical thing that happened. It's interesting because nobody knew about it. But at the same time, there wasn't much of a moral reflection on...
And one thing they didn't... I'm sorry, go ahead.
No, go ahead.
Well, and the one thing that they didn't close up, that I don't think, maybe correct me if I'm wrong,
mm-hmm.
was that... Okay, we've made this huge discovery is that this fella was not faithful to his wife and basically had this love affair with somebody, with someone else, right?
Mm-hmm.
And the creepy bad guys were trying to get that information first.
Yes.
Right? To do what with?
Yeah, that was kind of a plot hole.
The way I took it was so that they could publish it and get the credit for this huge discovery that basically, you know, undermined this guy's credibility.
Yeah.
Now, that there was never a discussion, and I thought that would have been interesting if at the end she had said, you know, because it was his... If she, I mean, Gwyneth Paltrow's character, Maude, if Maude had said, look, they've kept this a secret. The three of them, Ash, his wife, and the...
Christabel,
have kept this a secret for 100 years or 200 years, whatever it's going to be. We're gonna respect that. We're going to put this back in the box, and we're going to put it back in the ground. You know, but instead it was like, what wasn't said was, you know, as they were sitting there drinking their wine in front of the fire that night and reading the letters, what wasn't said was, tomorrow we're going to be filthy rich.
That's true.
We're going to have people knocking on our doors because we're going to bring Ash down.
Yeah, well, you know.
We're going to show him what he was really
I was thinking a little bit after, you know, the scene in the graveyard, which I thought that the baddies, you know, my mom at one point, you know, the two guys were sitting there kind of doing a conspiracy thing. They're like, oh, we'll get to the money and we'll get to, you know, and Mama's like, are we the baddies? You know, which is, a few of you might recognize a Mitchell and Webb quote. But, yeah, I thought that whole subplot kind of felt a little bit out of place in a literary historical thing, is that, oh, there have to be some sort of antagonist.
And
you didn't really care about them. You didn't know who they were.
And it was, you know, and they wanted to understand what was going on in their lives, but to what end?
You know? Yeah, and it didn't ask those questions.
No, it didn't. I mean, I would want to know what happened. I mean, I can understand why they wanted to find out. What it didn't answer is, what were they going to do?
What are the consequences of that
right,
sort of thing?
Right.
And I bet the novel does answer that. And I'm kind
of, right.
You know, I kind of want to read it because I think this just feels like a glimpse of something that, like I said, much bigger. But when they finally found all the information, they're sitting in front of the fire in a scene which I felt was really unusually brightly lit, almost kind of sunny.
I know.
And
you're right.
And they're talking about they've discovered that Ash died unhappy, Lamotte died unhappy, and that the child, which, you know, was not aborted, as it turns out, it lived her life without knowing who her parents were and hated her mother. And that's just, like, a totally miserable family story.
And the girl walked out into the lake with rocks in her pocket.
Oh, yeah. And poor Blanche, too, and the poor wife. You know, and it was just this terrible,
This road of destruction and ruin.
Yeah, which everybody else thought was...
And they tried to kind of spin it there at the end that the two of them were happy because, you know, he got to meet his little girl and...
Well,
right? And then
I thought that the ending was chilling. In the, you know, he was... I mean, it was kind of bittersweet, but you know, when she goes over that hill and drops the papers...
Yes.
That was, oh, man, you know. And I thought that was a glimpse of something that was a much more interesting type of story. It didn't pull the punch at the end. It didn't have them secretly meet, you know.
That's true.
And make up, and you know, I thought that added a little bit more gravitas.
Yeah, because she lived the rest of her life thinking he didn't know he had a daughter, and
or that he never met her.
Right.
And he lived the rest of his life thinking that she hated him.
Right. And that she went to weird seances.
But the yes. Yeah, but you know, the relevant point there is if somebody drops a document somewhere and it decays, then you might never know the truth about something that happened 200 years ago. It's like...
Well...
It's just saying that it was kind of a symbol almost of... The way, if you just lose one document, then a person can basically blink out of existence.
Man, just, you know, and if Hillary Clinton, speaking of blinking out of existence.
Yeah, about 200,000 you know, people.
If we just had 30,000 of those emails that hadn't blinked out of existence.
Miraculously, yeah.
Honey, do you see those emails? They were just here a few minutes. Oh, they're gone, sorry.
Oops. Well, I guess there was one other kind of theme, you know, which I've touched on a little bit already, is that Maude talks about being uncomfortable committing. The phrase she uses is that she's afraid of being burned up by love. Both Roland and Ash, the men, are presented as dangerous. Christabel calls Ash a dragon. So that they're both of the relationships are, you know, with men, you know, and it's notable that... That Christabel is a lesbian, and Maude is someone who's very, very feminist, very, very uninterested in really committing to a relationship with a man. Both of them have to, or at least that their relationships end up with them having to I'm trying to pick my words carefully here. It's just that they have to commit to a relationship with a man. And it's interesting how they deal with that.
Yeah, I can imagine this movie was not popular with large groups of the media elite or the right.
Well, on some level, it doesn't.
Some of those messages, because of those two messages right there.
It's not necessarily saying that that's a better type of relationship. It's just kind of saying like that it's more dangerous. That it's And
these two guys were anything but dangerous. They were not dangerous.
Oh, that's true. But I think that the fear both of the women have is of a dangerous type of man. That masculinity is something which is dangerous to them.
So who's the dangerous character in the movies?
In this movie?
No, in a movie.
In a movie?
In a movie. Who's a dangerous male figure in that regard?
Well, let's see. Basically, any terrible boyfriend, any abusive husband, any, you know, man who uses his masculinity and his strength in a way which is...
Like Donald Trump?
Well, yeah, you know.
T-Rump?
And I think both of them were afraid of being possessed, of being just a possession, you know. And they had to find a partner who wouldn't just want them just, you know, so that they could... have a trophy wife or whatever. But I guess the question at the end of the movie is that So Maude, instead of being icy, she learns to commit. She's more reckless. Is that a good decision? Because for Christabel, learning to be reckless, to commit to a man, you know, instead of a safer relationship with another woman, is that ends tragically for her. Being reckless just destroys her life. But for Maude, you know, what does that entail? I guess that's kind of a question. Because they both have different problems. The modern people are afraid of committing, and the couple in history, they had this great grand epic passionate affair, and that's another contrast, is that passion kind of belongs to the past, and now we just kind of have casual dates, you know, things that just don't matter as much, don't have as much weight. And that was sort of an interesting parallel too, is that in those days, romance really, really, really mattered. It really mattered who you were with. These days, it's just Tinder, you know.
That's sad. That's a sad observation. That's very cynical.
Yeah, I'm a cynical person. But at least Aaron Eckhart and Gwyneth Paltrow decide they're.
But you've always got eHarmony. That's the way you should look at that, right?
Because eHarmony is totally about commitment. But, yeah, so.
I don't know. I mean, that didn't feel. I mean, again, you're trying to get into the heads of these four people in that amount of time, and it was just. You know, you kind of had to ask yourself, this Gwyneth, would a Gwyneth Paltrow character like that fall that quickly that for someone like him? I mean, maybe so, because he was a.
It was
rather striking-looking feller. But
yeah, as we commented, me and my mom a little bit, but he was. It was kind of a good girl, bad boy trope, too. You know.
Anyway.
He actually tells her she needs to let her hair down, and that's the symbol of her. You know.
I guess
that is so clumsy. You know, that's a little bit of a trope there. But I did buy their relationship more than Ash and Lamotte.
Me too.
I thought that the director was more comfortable with them, and they.
Again, Gwyneth Paltrow.
Yeah,
I think,
that's
I
true.
I mean, she had a lot to do with that.
But she also got a little bit more backstory than
she
the
did.
Others.
She did.
And she delivered that very well.
She did.
But the director, like I said, he's an American, I think, and he seems much more comfortable with that. I thought that the historical investigation side of things felt like it could have come out of National Treasure, which is a historical mystery from a few years ago. It starred Nicolas Cage and...
this was like a cross between National Treasure and Indiana Jones and...
Maybe Pride and Prejudice or some sort of Bronte novel.
That's right.
Yeah, but it kind of lost by trying to mix them up in a blender. A little bit.
It could have been.
But the National Treasure bit was the bit the guy was most comfortable with, and I thought that their banter back and forth and them, you know.
Yeah, that was pretty good.
Stealing things together and kind of doing.
He's piecing it together and.
And that was they had fairly good chemistry. He did well as kind of a charming leading man. You know, he wasn't required to do too much except make jokes, and he did a pretty good job with that.
And not shave for a couple minutes.
Yeah, which was nice too. So
could you just go buy a razor, dude? Could you just buy a razor?
Yeah,
is that hard to do?
No, he'd be a little bit too perfect without the kind of scruff. That's my verdict. So I guess that brings up historical mysteries, though. You know, I've watched and read a few of them in my time. There's, like I said, National Treasure. There's The Da Vinci Code, which I haven't seen or read, but I know about because it was so popular back in the day. I know about The Daughter of Time, which I read like last year, I think, and that was a really interesting story. That one, I think, improved on this one because it had a little bit more weight. This one, and I think that the novel probably does fix this. This one didn't have as much weight because you knew these characters weren't real and you didn't know who they were. they didn't have as much sense of reality or you know.
Have you read The Dante Club?
I have, yeah. That was an interesting book.
That was a good book.
The Daughter of Time, though, it felt like it had a real consequence because the story is about a Scotland Yard detective who's been injured and he's in the hospital and somebody brings him a picture of Richard III, but he doesn't know that's who it is. And just looking at the guy, he thinks, what a trustworthy face. This guy looks trustworthy. He kind of analyzes faces. That's what he does as a detective. And then he realizes it's Richard III.
Physiognomy.
Yeah, physiognomy. And he thinks, that's not right, because he's the guy that murdered his nephews in the tower. He says, but did he? Do we know that happened? And so he starts investigating it. And this book came out, I don't know when, maybe the 80s, or maybe earlier, I can't remember. But it was, the author investigated so thoroughly that people started to question the historical, the actual fact, or the established facts that Richard III killed the boys. After that, suddenly, maybe he didn't do it. Maybe he was framed by Thomas More.
Man!
Yeah, and, I mean, that was drama. That was like, oh, wow, history is suddenly complicated. And that had a little bit more weight.
See, there, one of those little missing letters, right, that you were talking about earlier.
There you go. Yeah, because you just, one piece drops out, and suddenly the puzzle looks completely different.
Yep.
And that's why it's so dangerous so exciting and fun looking into historical mysteries. So, you know, and I've done a little bit of that myself, so I've enjoyed that. And that National Treasure and the Da Vinci Code have the same sort of consequence because they're both about really famous people doing really dramatic things.
Are we going to talk about the debate now?
We can talk about it now, I guess, because I think we're about finished. The only other thing I want to say, I guess, is that I thought some of the direction was really cool, the way they cut between the two times. Like, suddenly there'd be a modern character, and then you cut, and
the train was going overhead.
Well, you'd switch the camera over, and suddenly you'd be in the other time.
Yeah, that was pretty cool.
And that gave it a real sense of immediacy. That was really cool. And also, I thought that some of the side characters were kind of fun. Tom Hollander's lawyer, kind of a smarmy lawyer, and I thought he was really funny.
Yeah, and the old fellow that owned the manor.
Yeah, Graham Crowden. He's funny and everything, and he's got this really brassy voice. He sounds like he ought to be a P.G. Woodhouse character. So, he was really good in Inspector Allen. But yeah, now the patriarch wants to talk about the debate. So, though I guess, final thoughts on the movie. I've been critical, but I did enjoy the movie. I thought it was reasonably diverting. I didn't think it was perfect, but, you know, as kind of a entertaining rom-com, and after a long, hard day of packing, getting home from camping, it was pretty fun. So, you know.
And I had a snake fall out of the door when I opened the door to the restroom yesterday morning at the campground, so I was ready for some light-hearted banter.
Yeah, I was mostly ready to get back in my own bed because...
All right, go.
So, on the debate?
Yeah.
Well, who won? That's the real question, I guess. I think that, contrary to what everybody else is saying, I really don't think Trump came off very well at all. I think he came off like a complete buffoon. And I really think that the person who made the most impression, honestly, was Megyn Kelly. Because, and the moderators really, and some people were complaining and saying the moderators made it about themselves. And maybe that's true, but I think they only did that because the questions were so unusual in that type of setting. People are so used to journalists just being really polite and sensitive to the poor politicians who were up there, you know, having to defend themselves. And, oh, I like Jeb Bush. He's a nice old fella. I don't see why she had to ask him the mean question. She's the journalist. That's her job, you know. And I really think the journalists did very well, and that impressed me more than anything, and that made the debate as good as it was. And if people were thinking they were being too tough on him, well, look at the really good people and the way they answered those questions. The really good politicians knew how to answer those tough questions. Like, some of them got really tough, gotcha, almost gotcha type questions, but they could field them really well. And that's got to be a And that's something you've got to be able to do if you're competing to get the one of the top jobs in the land, you know. It's not a job for wimps. So, yeah, people who can think on their feet, people who can make decisions and speak eloquently, that those are important elements of what the job requires. This is basically an interview. So, who won? I think that there's no clear winner, but I think that several candidates did very well. I thought that Ted Cruz did pretty well for himself. I thought Scott Walker did pretty well. He was a little bit, he wasn't very memorable necessarily. Huckabee did quite well. He didn't make any gaffes or anything, so he was a presence there. Chris Christie and Rand Paul are mostly remembered for just bickering. So, yeah, though I thought Rand Paul made some pretty good points, but he undermined it later on. Let's see, who else was on there?
Kasich,
he made an impression, mostly because he was kind of somebody I'd never heard of, I didn't know anything about, and he was different. He was kind of weird and out there, and he didn't really know what he was going to do. So, yeah, he did pretty interestingly. Carson was kind of just there trying to hold his own, and he was just being kind of the nice family friend at the debate, and you're just wondering, why are you here, sir? You know, I like him, but
his numbers have went up.
Gone up, yeah.
Mm. Oh, yeah, gone up, too. They've gone up.
Gosh.
They have
anyway.
Gone up.
Okay, there we go.
That's what I understand. Mr. T-Rumps have went up, or at least Holden.
I wonder, you know, because I hear different things on different polls, and I wonder who does those polls. It's... You know, it's just,
Yes.
You know, and especially in the aftermath of the debate, you know, in the first few days after the debate, I was thinking, how can anybody still like this guy? After the comments about Megyn Kelly and all of that stuff, I'm like, man, you know, I think Charles Cook predicted, he says, by the end of the week, Donald Trump is going to be Roderick Spode. Says, this is Eulalie 2016, if anybody gets a P.G. Woodhouse reference. And I was really hoping that that would be the case, but it's looking like that probably will not be. We're going to have to endure him.
I think you're going to be enduring him a long time. But I think...
Well, hopefully they can punch at him long enough so that he loses enough money that...
No, he's got plenty of money. He can spend money just from now on advertising out of his own pocket. He's talking about $1 billion, you know, if he wanted to.
He has said that he'll bankrupt himself getting the White House if he needs to.
Which is an interesting way of putting it, but
definitely the guy you want in charge of your finances.
He's gonna be around. He's gonna be around a good long while. But I think that a lot of it is name recognition as well. I mean, I think it's what Bush's was, quite frankly, up until the debate anyway. That Bush was the, or until Trump announced, is that he was the front runner because he had such great name recognition. I mean, you're talking about 17 people running.
Yeah.
So I don't think that the normal Republican, they might recognize the name Scott Walker, but they're not really that keyed in on what he's done, maybe.
Yeah.
And certainly that's the case with a Kasich or, you know, heaven help us, George Pataki or Jim Gilmore.
Yeah.
But I think if some of those other guys start to drop out, which I think could happen relatively soon, then those numbers start to shift. But I don't know.
Yeah, this feels a little bit like...
It's going to be very interesting.
This feels a little like the Hunger Games, you know, people are starting to get killed off.
Yeah.
Though... I understand that in the next CNN debate, and I'm not sure, so don't quote me on this, but I think that they're only inviting 16 candidates, and I think Gilmore has not made the cut. Because I'm not entirely sure, but...
Well, I'm sure that's the case. And they really just shouldn't have Pataki on there, and you could probably trim off six more. I mean, I didn't like the format that Fox did, but they did it very well. It turned out very well for a lot of reasons, because you got to see a lot of the candidates, even the early group. And I think it would be a mistake to have 16 on the stage. That is insane. They need to break them up in groups of 8 and draw numbers, and you got 8 and 8. You know, mix it up, whatever.
Yeah, I mean, it's just a joke having Donald Trump in the middle of the stage, but...
I mean, and that's fine, but you know, it's just insane that you get up there and you talk about what a tough guy you are, and then immediately start whining about the questions. You know, it's just
I just don't understand this sensibility that journalists are obliged to be nice to politicians.
I want all my journalists to
go. That anybody's obliged to be nice to politicians, but especially journalists.
I want journalists, regardless of who's sitting in front of them, to think that they're you know, Adolf Hitler sitting in front of them, and go after their jugular, regardless of their political stance, regardless of who they are, because these are people who are trying to wield power over millions of other people, and the only people between us and them are the journalists, and that's a charge that they need to take more seriously.
Yeah, and the journalists should be on the side of the people.
Absolutely.
I mean, I've said this before, I've written it before, the journalists represent the people. They are the megaphone for the people's concerns, and they're the only hammer we have to strike back against politicians, because politicians don't care, since they keep on getting elected and elected and elected. They're not held responsible for anything.
A few years ago, when the Tea Party movement was kind of getting started, I'll never forget, there was an event where out on the streets of Chicago or probably New York, and this CNN reporter was basically tearing into this guy who was holding his kid, and she was tearing into him about taxes, you know.
Oh yeah, I remember that.
And that just made me so angry, because, you know, because he's Joe American. I mean, who's he? You know, nobody knows who he is. Nobody cares who Manuel is.
Yeah.
But she was standing there defending the government in her role as a journalist. It was absolutely shameful.
That truce to power, though.
It just really hurts me.
Yeah, and that's why I liked Megyn Kelly so much, is that she really was speaking truth to power.
Absolutely.
You know, not that I think that really Trump can... make her disappear or anything, but
the only thing I took issue with a little bit is when she said, "When did you become a Republican?" That she could have phrased that differently to make it more palatable. But it's a fair question, and she's like most of the Fox guys. I mean, she's a little more, you know, bombastic in her questioning, I guess you'd say. But it's a fair question.
I didn't like the way the God question at the end of the debate either.
No, I
just thought that was out of place.
That was.
And especially the way it was phrased.
I think there was some basis for it from somebody. I don't know what it was. Don't ask me what it was.
That just didn't make sense. I mean, there's no way they'd ask that of Democrat candidates. And
there were so many questions they could have phrased better. Or
yeah, that one, I mean...
That would have been more interesting.
I think that it could have been phrased better. It's like, have you received divine revelation? I mean, what sort of question is that anyway?
Yeah.
I mean, thankfully, Ted Cruz came back with, you know, punching. He's like, oh, you know, he said, I hear from God every day when I read the Bible. And I'm like, yeah. There we go.
But
I wanted to hear Marco Rubio answer it, but he didn't get the chance.
Not really. But the gal to watch.
Oh, yeah, we need to mention Fiorina. Because
yeah.
She pretty much managed to win both debates, because... She not only won her debate, but she turned the primary talking points about the other debate, which is to say Trump's completely idiotic sexism, into a story about her.
Man, she is an amazing politician.
She arguably surpasses all the other candidates, and quite clearly outclasses them without any dispute at all.
I mean, I've grown up with it, and I've watched, you know, many, many, many people on before, but she is the real deal. Now, I don't know if she can get by, you know, laying off 30,000 people and sending her job to China and some of the the backroom brawls at Hewlett Packard and all that good stuff. I know that's a tall order to get around, but if anybody can get around it and talk her way through that and explain to the American people why that came about, she's the one to do it. She is very good. At this point, I'm not kidding. I would put my money on her. I think it's a Fiorina Rubio ticket.
Man, I love the new Republican Party.
That would be a very formidable if she can get past those two or three questions. Which I think she can.
Republicans are just all old white men, aren't they? Yep. Anyway, and she's so winsome about the way she presents things.
Yep.
She talked to Katie Couric. It's a wonder that Ted Cruz kept his patience with Katie Couric because she was being so obnoxious. But Fiorina, it looked like she just wanted to kind of go across the table and just put her arm around her and just explain to her where she was wrong. It was just so... It's like, I know you can't help being a complete idiot.
But the other thing about Fiorina is she's the antidote to Donald Trump.
Yes.
She is quite possibly the antidote because...
Just by being who she is.
Yes, because all the others are career politicians, right?
Yeah.
And part of the reason...
Except for Carson.
Correct, right. But part of the reason that you've got the Trump and Carson bump in the polls is because all this outrage at politicians, right? And
yeah.
They want to hang Mitch McConnell and they want to kill John Boehner, and there's some real reasons to do that. But Fiorina is the outsider. She's the one that can come in and quite possibly pick up that mantle, plus the moderate type, the more moderate, you know, Republican establishment type thing. So, gosh, you know, if she can break into the top five or six, she'll make it. I would put my money on her. I really would, because her skills are phenomenal.
Well, I know a mutual friend of ours was kind of bringing up this question. From a Christian standpoint, what do you think about a woman being a president or you know, holding that position of authority?
It may not be ideal, but I don't have a problem with it. I mean, with there would be certain circumstances I haven't thought about this a lot, but generally speaking, I look at Thatcher. I mean, I go back to Thatcher as kind of the role model there.
Well, I've thought it through, and I've kind of the twin topics for me is, you know, women holding leadership in the church and women holding leadership outside the church, and those are two different things. And I've also my position on women inside the church has kind of evolved over time too, but that's a topic for another day. Anyway, I don't think there's anything in the Bible that says a woman can't be a political leader, and Deborah is a particular example of, you know, a woman that is a political leader. However, a relevant point in that story is that if you look at it just kind of from a literary subtext point of view, all of the men in that story are complete wimps. You know, she asks her general to go out with her to do something, and he won't do it unless she goes with him because he's a coward. That's also the story when Sisera, I think, or Sennacherib, who ends up running away from the battle and killed by a woman after drinking from after she gives him more milk to drink. She gives him a bottle of milk and puts him to bed and, you know, kind of sings him a lullaby, and then she drives a stake through his temple. And so all of the men in that story have failed in one way or another, and kind of the subtext there is to say, okay, if you have a woman leader, then that's not her fault, that's the men's fault, you know.
Yeah.
And so, you know, if Carly Fiorina can beat all of those men up there, that's not her fault, that's theirs.
Yeah,
I
agree.
I think there's and if we can obviously see that she's a better candidate, then we have a responsibility to go with her.
And I'll say this, is that the other thing that no one's talking about in this upcoming election is, you know, they talk a lot about the different votes, the different subgroups, and I'm not going to, I don't separate us into groups anymore. But that, you know, this group of people will vote this way, and this group of people will vote that way, you know, and they'll break this way, and they'll break that way. But one group that nobody talks about is the men vote. Okay? And I could be completely wrong, all right? And you're just going to think this is a sexist thing. But if Hillary Clinton's on the ticket, and she can be a pretty shrill person, okay? I think guys are going to look at that and say, do I really want to listen to her for the next four years? You know, and that, when I say shrill, I mean the way that she can kind of be kind of snarky sometimes, and just kind of.
Ted Cruz has a little bit of the same problem.
He does have some
well,
problem.
Rand Paul definitely has right. That problem.
Yes, he does. That's right. I agree. I mean, and she's got other strengths, but I just wonder about that men vote, and they do vote.
And for women, I've noticed this on Tumblr. They try and spin that as Hillary being kind of girl power type stuff, and I was just like, no. I mean, she's just like the kind of this granny out there who's a multimillionaire, and I just don't see her as kind of a spunky girl power type thing. That I just don't think you can sell that narrative very convincingly.
And I think
especially if Carly Fiorina.
Yeah, if it came down to Carly Fiorina and Hillary Clinton, I think, generally speaking, you know, that the men would go with Carly Fiorina just because they've seen Hillary for years and years. They know kind of what way that the Clintons operate, and I think she would do very well. I'd love to see her in a debate against Clinton. I think she would take her. There wouldn't be anything left. I mean, she would just take her to pieces, I think.
Well, we had better wrap it up because we're about 7 minutes over time now.
All right.
So, anyway, we have really no idea what we're going to talk about next week because I have not thought that far. But maybe we'll talk about Gosford Park because I watched half of that movie the other day, and this might be a chance for Jeremy Northam to.
I think I tried watching that a while back and didn't get anywhere with it. I didn't understand it.
It's like Downton Abbey, but with murder.
Yeah.
So, I like it okay. I think it's a little bit cynical about kind of some of the old-fashioned structures and everything. Downton seems to like its lords and ladies a bit more. But it did have some very nicely directed sequences. I haven't finished the movie yet, though.
We'll have to figure that out.
Yeah, or maybe we could watch Hot Fuzz, which I just watched. And now for something totally different. Anyway.
Thanks for listening.
Yep. In the meantime, you can find us online at the Pilgrims Podcast blog, or you can find us at our respective blogs, Longish and What's He That Wishes So. We're on Twitter. We're on Facebook. You can email us at thepilgrimspodcast@gmail.com. Let us know what you think. Comment on the blog, and we'll read your comments on the air. In the meantime, goodbye.
Adios.
All the money that e'er I had, I spent it in good company. And all the harm I've ever done, alas, it was to none but me. And all I've done for want of wit, to memory now I can't recall. So fill to me the parting glass, good night and joy be to you all. Parting glass. that e'er I had. They're sorry for my